Welcome to The World Next Week's special summer entertainment episode. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
In the past, we've done a summer reading special episode and a back-to-school reading episode on The World Next Week, but this year, for understandable circumstances, we have more time on our hands than ever, and we've decided to expand the range of our recommendations to not only include favorite reads under quarantine, but also beloved films, videos, or even fellow podcasts and more.
Joining us for this special episode is Gabrielle Sierra, host of The World Next Week's sister podcast, Why It Matters. Gabrielle is an arts and culture journalist with more than a decade of experience reporting in New York City. Her work has appeared in publications such as Billboard, Curbed, Gothamist, Metro, and Paste. Before joining CFR, Gabrielle worked as a curator and editor at Facebook. Gabrielle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Gabrielle, let's get right to it. We're going to start with your recommendations. Kick us off. What's a book you've read recently that you simply couldn't put down?
Okay, before I get into my book selection, I just wanted to say that when you guys asked me to come on this episode, I kind of assumed you were looking for nonfiction recommendations. And, you know, so I was thinking about it and thinking about it, and just the more I thought about it, I realized how important fiction is for me and my understanding of the rest of the world. And, you know, I think that's something we do at Why It Matters too. We try to get at least one good story from our guests because I think that stories stick in people's minds. And, you know, they just give them something they can remember and build on. So with that little precursor, my recommendation is a novel called A Burning. And it's the debut work by a woman named Megha Majumdar. She's an editor at Catapult Magazine in New York. The book takes place in India, and it tells this intertwined story about three people who are just striving for a better life in one way or another. One is a young Muslim woman living in a Kolkata slum, and she gets accused of carrying out a terrorist act after she posts an anti-government statement on Facebook. Another is a Hijra, which is often called a third gender in India, and she wants to be a movie star, and she's facing her own obstacles. And then the third is a physical education teacher who is recruited by a local right-wing party as he just, you know, strives for a more prestigious position in life. And I blew through this book in 2 days. I thought it was beautiful and timely and sad and at times funny, which, you know, is just the winning combination. And after I finished, you know, I took a look at some of the reviews and some of her interviews. And, you know, the author was saying that as she finished writing, her fiction was echoing what she was seeing in India and around the globe with the rise of right-wing parties and the rise of nationalism. And I think that you felt this. The whole book is taking place at this moment where you can really sense the precarious position the characters are in. And it manages to comment on the rise of authoritarianism and the incredible trap of income inequality without focusing directly on it. And again, if I put my Why It Matters hat on for a second, you know, I could see A Burning as a bridge for people into Indian culture and society because I found myself looking things up as I went because I wanted to learn and I didn't know them. And I also wanted to eat almost all of the food she described, which I take as a good sign. So I just think it's a great book and just a hell of a first novel.
So how did you come across the book, Gabrielle?
So a friend of mine, a fellow journalist, actually recommended it to me, whose, you know, recommendations I take to heart. And then I had also, it had gotten a really great review in The New Yorker. So I just have been seeking out books that sort of accomplish this dual purpose of, it's actually marketed as a thriller, and I love thrillers, but it still exposes you to this whole other part of the world, and it really fell into both categories.
Well, you were in the Indian space a little bit. First of all, I should say, I totally agree with your comment about the role of fiction also being an important driver to understanding the world. But you were in this space recently on the Why It Matters with an episode you all did on the WhatsApp and its role, its sort of outsized role there. Were there aspects of this book that further informed you there? Did you feel like you came into it knowing a little bit more of the lay of the land?
100%. The research that we did for that episode gave me more than just a baseline, but it gave me an understanding of what's going on there. And, you know, like I said, the main character is a Muslim woman facing this persecution. And I think that a lot of the aspects that we actually didn't get to explore and Why It Matters, because the podcast is only 22 minutes and there's only so much we can get into, were explored in this book. And, you know, it definitely overlapped, which was great because it makes me feel like our episodes are timely. And also, you know, this book is the same. So that's my first rec. How about you, Jim?
Well, Gabrielle, I've been doing a lot of reading on history for some work I have been doing. And so I have gotten to read some great books over the last several months. I got a lot more reading done than I anticipated. Being able to work from home, got through David McCullough's biography of John Adams, Ron Chernow's biography of Alexander Hamilton, George Herring's great book on American foreign policy, From Colony to Superpower. And I'm just about to start reading Tim McGrath's James Monroe's A Life. But the book I want to flag for people is a book by Jill Lepore called These Truths, A History of the United States. Professor Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard. She's also a staff writer for The New Yorker. She took on the challenge of writing a one-volume history of the United States. Now, it's a very long book. It comes in, I think, about 930 pages. So it is a book that I have to put down. And I can't say I got through it in 2 days.
Fair enough.
You did, Gabrielle, with yours. But I mean, it's a remarkable accomplishment because it's very well written. Anyone who's read Dr. Lepore's work in The New Yorker, she's a very good writer. It's a real challenge to tell the history of a country as large, as complicated as the United States. She does it remarkably well. And I think the book is particularly appropriate at this juncture because what she attempts to do is to make more central in the telling of the history of the United States, the role of women, but also sort of the lasting, enduring legacy of slavery and racism and its impact on the development of the United States. And obviously, given, you know, what's happened currently, that really resonates. And it's just, to me, a remarkably well-done book. And at various junctures, what it reminds you is that we have a tendency to mythologize our past and to think back on the past as somehow things were simpler, politics were easier, people were nicer. And in fact, that hasn't been the case. And I find actually some of the most interesting chapters were the chapters she wrote on the early years of the American Republic. And we have a tendency to think of the framers as these giants of wisdom who came together and handed down this document that has carried us over 200 years. And as she tells the story, she reminds us of how much indecision they had, how much they debated the decisions they made. And in fact, when they started taking this system and putting into operation, how much they deviated from their principles when they were faced with outcomes that they wanted. And it's a really, truly great read. And I really want to recommend it also because it's pretty clear from public opinion polls that a lot of people don't know very much about American history. And I think this is a great place to start.
It sounds like covering a lot in a small window, even if it is a hefty book. Do you find, you know, that you feel like at moments it tried to cover too much? Because sometimes I feel like that tends to happen when people are trying to give an exhaustive history.
Well, obviously, any book that attempts to tell the history of an entire country over essentially 400 years going back to the original colonies is going to leave a lot of things out. And so I think one of the easiest criticisms is to say, well, you should have spent more time on this and you neglected that. And if you take a time to read reviews or people who complain about the role of Native Americans is not developed sufficiently, people argue that she doesn't give enough attention to technology. People argue that there's more to be said about the role of immigrants. And all of that has an element of truth. But again, and to me, rather than sort of focusing on what stories get left out, I think we really have to take a nod to how well the story is told. And I think what's actually really interesting is in the beginning of the book, Dr. Lepore has an essay in which she talks about how past writers have approached the question of telling the history of the United States, and that in some sense, all histories of a country are of their own times. They reflect the passions, the concerns, the issues. And she notes how differently American history has been covered in various past histories. And I think that's really worth keeping in mind. And my sense is from the way she's written the book that she's making no claim that hers is the only way to tell the story or that there aren't things she didn't get to, because the reality is there's a lot you're going to leave. You'd appreciate this doing a podcast on the cutting room floor. But certainly, if you want something that is readable, that helps you understand the story of who we are as a people and what it means when we talk about creating a more perfect union, I think These Truths is a place to start.
Jim, you picked a book that's on my to-do list, my growing stack of books I want to tuck into. But I was wondering, for a sort of anguished public right now, you know, dealing with the cumulative effects of a pandemic and economic shock and racial strife, you know, are there things in here? It seems like you mentioned there's a lot of sense of sort of the long view of America and kind of potentially some solace in the fact that the country's had a lot of heavy hurdles in the past. Are there some things that we can look to from the past that seemed also insurmountable and the country got through? I'm looking for a little bit of hope here.
Well, certainly. But I think that's actually one of the underlying messages throughout the book. And it's refreshing to remember that this is not the first generation to encounter hardship, difficulty, to be surprised by history. If you look at American history, whether you're talking about famously the Civil War and the havoc and heartache that wrought on the country and what followed on from it, the divisions over how to rebuild the country after the Civil War, Reconstruction, the end of Reconstruction. You talk about the integration of immigrants into society and the long time it took to do that, the lingering history of racism, Jim Crow in society, the Great Depression. I mean, the history of America is not a history of just one great thing after another. It is a history of a lot of heartache, a lot of division, disagreement, often very bitter disagreement. And again, we tend to think somehow there was this golden age in the past where politics was a genteel sport. And I'll just say, go back and read what These Truths has to say about the initial years of the Washington presidency, and Washington, the only president elected not once, but twice unanimously. But there were deep divisions in the American public over the vision of what the United States should be. And that sort of debate over who are we, what values we want to embody, what do we want to accomplish as a people, that has been playing out now for more than two centuries. And I think historically, we've gotten closer to this perfect union. But I think as the book makes clear, and I think our own current events make clear, we are a long way from having achieved a more perfect union.
Does it ever bum you out, the idea that, like, when you examine history, we've been here before?
I think it both can be depressing, Gabrielle, but it also can be liberating to realize that we are not, the first generation to have been tested, that perhaps our travails are not as severe and significant as we think they are, and also to provide you with the notion that even though there have been bad times, we have a long history of finding a way to get through those bad times to something better. Maybe we don't get there quickly. Maybe we don't get there easily. Maybe we don't get there in quite exactly the right way. But I think it is a story of, in essence, an idea, what Dr. Lepore calls these truths about sort of the principles, the ideas that we think we are about as a society, trying to find a way to translate them from lofty words that may be uttered on important days like the 4th of July or Memorial Day, but to take them and translate them from the ethereal realm into the day-to-day realm. How do you ensure justice for people? How do you ensure what we talk about when we say all people are equal, all people are entitled to equal representation under the law? And this is a long history in this country of not living up to those principles, but also a long history in this country of trying to find a way to live up to who we say we are as a people.
There's your silver lining, Bob. We got it. Shining
Thank you.
Light.
Thanks for pulling that out, Gabriel.
Let me ask you, Bob, what have you been reading that you really want to flag for our listeners?
So I'm going to go back a little bit in time. Mine isn't fresh off of the presses, but I think it has a great deal of relevance. There's a book I've been meaning to read for a long time. It's been haunting me from my nightstand. And I found my moment with the pandemic and so forth. And it's The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan. Now, this book made a huge splash. I was well aware of it when it came out, about basically the role of the industrial food process in the United States, big corn, but also America's eating habits. Pollan starts out by noting what he calls the country's national eating disorder, but also the staggering amount of choices that the country has. And you go to a typical grocery store. So as I'm walking through in the early part of the pandemic, I was kind of the person tasked with the grocery runs early on. And, so you got very, very familiar with your grocery store and very intimate, and also with the things that started vanishing. And I got caught up in the whole food supply chain cycle. We talked a little bit about it on one of our podcasts, Jim, about how this affected the meat, because all of a sudden the meat workers started becoming ill, and that had a huge impact because that industry is so consolidated. Essentially, what Pollan finds is it starts out as almost half the book is a story about corn, the astonishing rise of corn as essential food product in this country. And that goes for anything from Pop-Tarts to certain preservative coverings, and certainly the meat, because the story of corn is partially the overproduction of corn. And he goes into that in engrossing, fascinating detail. And he goes everywhere from Iowa cornfields to one of these major industrial meat processing plants, and kind kind of walks through how that came to be, the massive amounts of overproduction and how corn suddenly had to be, there had to be finding uses for it. Because the corn was overproduced, farmers were not getting good return on it. Farmers needed to be subsidized. Corn needed to continue to be produced and it needed to find an outlet. So it was started to be fed to cattle. Grain-fed cattle suddenly beefed up quicker. It wasn't 4 years of grazing on grass. It was a year and a half on corn. And the really graphic description he has of some of these industrial meat plants of what these animals are, you know, what the processes involve could move you quickly into becoming a vegetarian. But his point is not to make you become a vegetarian necessarily, but to become more informed about the choices that have gone into the country's eating practices and how they have become distorted over time. And how this becomes, I think, a bigger story for like a foreign policy podcast is because I think it impacts things like trade choices, like environmental impact. The U.S. exporting, you know, corn around the world and the growing demand for it in a number of places. Corn is now also obviously going into ethanol for powering cars, but also the reliance on corn to feed livestock, chicken, even fish is quite staggering. It has an impact on the nutritional value of those animals as well. So I just found myself like further and further climbing deeper into this labyrinth of the American food process and becoming a bit dismayed, but also a little bit heartened because he does start to head into a different direction as well and goes to these places where there's more organically raised animals. Clearly, you can see he makes the case for why that's a better approach. But also, I think there are economies of scale that must be overcome for these types of operations to feed the number of Americans that are currently fed very cheaply, by the way, by the sort of corn-based food economy. And it's the cheapness of food is really hard to deny. I mean, the cheapness of a large cut of beef, for example, or all the certain things that Americans come to rely on from fast food to fine dining, it really makes you think. And it's a book that's continuing to make me think, and I'm still kind of processing it all.
Has it changed the way you eat?
It's changed the way I shop, certainly. I mean, I'm going to the, I was already kind of veering towards some of the organic sections of the stores, even though there's clearly a price difference for those foodstuffs. In some cases, I was pushed towards those out of necessity because the rest of the food was being bought up in this sort of end of days type of shopping that people were doing early on in the pandemic. But, you know, I like organic eggs actually a lot better than the sort of the other ones that come through that are $1 to $2 cheaper a dozen. And you do taste the difference in some of the other organically raised. And again, you have to also check into the whole organically raised labeling that's going on. A lot of big food concerns have actually bought up some of the organic lines as well because they want to have a piece of that action. So it has made me think more about it. It's made me think more about, you know, eating plant-based foods. I'm not ready to be a vegetarian yet, but I'm certainly becoming a bit more sober about meat and the role of meat.
Bob, I want to ask you about this because I know the book was written, 2007, and mm-hmm. a lot has sort of changed on this front. A lot hasn't changed. And one of the things I found most impressive is the development of plant-based alternatives to meat. And my daughter's a vegan, so I have eaten a lot of these. And I would say some of the first entrants into the sweepstakes were not very good. But I will tell you, some of the plant-based substitutes I've eaten recently, whether sausages, hamburgers, and the like, have been terrific. I would not have known they weren't meat. They're much more friendly to the environment, and they're actually relatively cheap and likely to get cheaper. Do you have any sense of how that section of the food industry is likely to evolve in the years to come?
It's a great question, Jim. And I think, you know, if Michael Pollan had his choice, and I should look around to see if he's written recently on it, but that would be a whole extra chapter for this book or else just a sequel because it's become such a big, I think, additional industry. I think for me, last summer was a tipping point because our family decided we were going to try to take a crack at some of the non-meat burgers and we all kind of liked them. You know, I think a lot of them derive from various combinations, very carefully calibrated in labs of peas and beans. So, you know, you're getting a lot of protein. In some ways, there is still, surprisingly, and I have to look into this a bit more, there is still an amount of fat and carbs and whatever that makes them not hugely more healthy than eating a burger. But the absence of the whole process that goes into your average burger is stunning. And I think you're seeing the big players are starting to buy up some of these firms that have pioneered the meatless burgers. And so I think it's here to stay. I think you just kind of look at the market reaction. You look at some of the either almost IPOs or IPOs that some of these companies have offered, and the interest is there. What Pollan tapped into was this giant industry that seemed to be going inexorably in one direction. direction and was bothering a lot of people in a country that has obviously agrarian roots and a good number of small farmers still who were trying to and starting to, I think, find a way to be viable, you know, with their small products. So you have the locavore movement, small farmers able to sell their produce to restaurants nearby. Now, what the pandemic has done to that, I don't know. I think like a place like New York City, for example, was this incredible magnet for all these Hudson Valley, New York farmers. You know, I think that hurt them. But I think back to your original question, Jim, I do think it's a whole area that is, you know, could be part of a tectonic shift there. I think there's been a steady growth in the number of vegetarians, if not vegans, in the country. And I think the ingenuity of the food industry, including the big corn, shall we say, to move in that direction, to go where the tastes are, it shouldn't be underestimated.
Okay, but let me give you a pro tip. If you're having a plant-based burger and you want to keep it healthy and keep the calories low, don't put cheese on it. Don't put mayo on it. Don't add bacon. Then it's no longer plant-based.
Those are all the good things.
And don't put it on a bun
actually,
either.
No, but actually what I will say is, and this is what's most impressive, and there's a whole science to this, is they're developing these plant-based products, is what they call mouthfeel. So that when you eat it, the sensation in your mouth mimics what it is when you would eat an actual burger, meat-based product.
That's the Impossible Burger, right? That's their big thing, is that
right.
It looks, tastes, smells like a burger.
And the look thing, I must say, from my own subjective viewpoint, but I think others share this, it really does look close. It's not like a tofu burger or something else. Yep. This you can fake yourself into thinking, okay, I'm sitting down having a burger here.
Did you do like a blind taste test kind of thing?
I think for one of my kids, we did. I didn't. I already knew about it. I was too much in the know. But
what I'd like to do now, Bob, if we may, is to shift the focus of our discussion, to pivot away from books and to talk about movies or documentaries or podcasts that we've seen or listened to recently that we want to recommend to our audience. Gabrielle, you're first up. What do you have to offer us?
Yeah. So for this one, I picked a film called The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson. It's a documentary about a transgender activist whose body was found in the Hudson River in the summer of 1992. And her death was ruled a suicide, but many people believe it was actually a homicide. And they blame the police for not investigating the way that they feel that they should have. This came out last year, but I picked it for three reasons. One, I watched it this year. Two, June is Pride Month. And three, we are currently in a moment where people are questioning the role of the police and the presence of police violence. And we're seeing all this activism in the form of protest, and that is all in the film. So it's a Netflix original directed by David France, who is actually an investigative reporter who did the 2012 documentary, How to Survive a Plague, which is all about the AIDS epidemic in the late 80s. And the film itself follows an activist named Victoria Cruz, and she sort of sets out to reopen the case on her own, and she tracks down old friends and family of Marsha's. She even talks to the police involved in the case. And through her investigation, the film really goes on to tell this larger story about the transgender community, their fight for rights, their fight for even basic safety, which they are still fighting for today. And I think that it's just, you know, at times the film does feel like it's trying to accomplish a lot, understandably, in a small window. But I thought it was truly fascinating.
Gabrielle, is it like a cold case that's being, you know, reinvestigated and you're starting to kind of unpack it in a few ways, in addition to obviously getting insights into this whole community?
It's exactly that. You know, it's also got that sort of mystery thriller element, but, you know, it's a case that was sort of open and shut back then for the police. I ruled a suicide and that was that. And, you know, there's just a lot of people still involved in the community who want to see it thought through again, especially now and today. And, you know, it also, while the film is going, they're showing a couple of modern day cases that are also being processed.
Gabrielle, on that, as you're looking back at a case from 28 years ago, what sort of jumped out at you as this is different today versus this is still a problem today?
I think a big difference of today is an obvious one, which is just people have phones, people have social media. There are networks and platforms where people could voice their concerns, where I think it was much easier for a community that was already being silenced to be silenced once again, even in the face of what was for them a very big deal, perhaps a murder, at least a suspicious death that they felt was a huge blow to the community. And I don't think that that would go silenced today in the same way. However, I do think that this community is still facing the same challenges. I wish I could say that looking at this case and watching the movie felt very different from something that, you know, the community would be going through today. Sadly, I think there's still a lot of work to be done. So that's my documentary pick. Over to you. How about you, Bob?
I also picked something that came out last year that I caught up with this year. I feel like I was late to the party, but it really hit me. I picked it up just before the pandemic. The reason why it hit me even before then and since then is because of some parallels that a number of other people have drawn. What I'm talking about is Chernobyl, the HBO series that came out in the summer of 2019. A major incident happens in a communist authoritarian country. The officials, you know, quash any reporting of it at the great cost of local lives and livelihoods. But eventually they have to, because of international pressure and other reasons, they have to acknowledge what happened. And so what I'm paralleling here, obviously, is the Wuhan virus, as COVID-19 was originally known, and the outbreak there, the initial suppression of information about it from Chinese authorities, and then the eruption of and the explosion at Chernobyl in 1986. The reason it hit me, for a number of reasons, I thought I knew most that you can know about that, the circumstances around Chernobyl. I wrote a lot and edited a lot about it in my days for Radio Free Europe in the 90s and early aughts. And what's ingenious about it, and I know there's a number of Russians in particular have pointed out flaws in some of the assumptions and some of the assertions in the piece, but it comes across as just an expertly done documentary. You feel like you're taking part in the sort of the reenactment of what really happened. And part of that goes to the just amazing way in which the creators of this miniseries recreated 1986 Chernobyl, Ukraine, Soviet styles, Soviet infrastructure. Everything was just really well captured. And then just kind of walking through the enormity of what happened. And as it dawned on the Russians, as scientific officials were allowed to get some voice in both what was happening and what the consequences were if they didn't act quickly enough. I just found it fascinating. Couldn't wait to stream the next episode after each one was finished. And I found it very thought-provoking. And again, it's not an exact parallel to what's happened vis-a-vis China and the coronavirus, but there are costs that are paid, not just domestically, but internationally, for inaction, for misinformation, for quashing information. And I think those are some of the bigger lessons while we still look at and we still sort of deal with the ramifications of Chernobyl itself.
I absolutely loved that show. I watched it all pretty quickly. So I started reading Voices from Chernobyl, the Svetlana Alexievich book afterwards, and my library demanded it back before I was able to finish. But I thought the form of that was incredible, and especially reading it after seeing the series and these firsthand accounts, you know, did you feel that the creators of the series did the book justice?
I think one of the big issues with the creation of the series was a fictionalized character who was created, who was seen as sort of an amalgam of, it was a way of telling a bunch of complicated stories and sort of encapsulating it in one person who didn't really exist, but was an amalgam of people who were involved from the Belarusian angle and from other parts of the scientific community. But I think, you know, I think it captured the spirit. I think part of the things that made it so compelling was all these different vignettes. You know, it's the firefighter who shows up first, you know, completely unprotected and is part of this early group of people who are just horribly poisoned by radiation and have horrible deaths. And then there's the scientific community. There's the apparatchik who ends up being one sort of the quasi-hero of it by making sure that he moves the mountains that are needed, literally, to make sure that they were stopping the burning of the core of the reactor. Again, I know quite a bit about it, but I was gripped by it. I was kind of like, what's going to happen? You know, I think it was just so well done in that regard that I would highly recommend it as just entertainment, but also as something that's thought-provoking and makes you think about, again, the interconnectivity of the world, too.
Bob, you mentioned that you were struck by Chernobyl and were thinking about it in terms of the current crisis with the pandemic, the origins of the virus in China. Can you sort of spell that a little bit more? What do you see as in parallel and what do you see as being different?
I remember when I first joined Radio Free Europe in Munich back in the early 90s, there were people who were still talking about Chernobyl, which was 6 years before that. And partly it was the creepiness of how it broke, that Western European countries were starting to register radiation levels. They were starting, the Swedes were reporting it, Germans were. There was a great deal of panic, actually, about what level of danger this posed and the degree to which the Soviets were acknowledging or doing anything about it. And people were telling me about plans that, you know, some of them actually moved with their family. Just took extended holidays, didn't drink the milk for several years, even though they were assured that milk from, you know, northern Germany was safe or whatever. And so I think it's the initial suppression of information. And you have this, I remember when very late 2019, early 2020, we were seeing reports coming out of Wuhan and about a potential worrying virus. I remember our colleague Yan Zhang Huang saying, you know, the Chinese are not being forthcoming on this. There are things they're not sharing. They've known about this for longer than they've let on. And then the Chinese started to bit by bit acknowledge what was going on. I think the Chinese having a position of influence at the World Health Organization, I think were able to potentially influence even the WHO raising alarm flags. Unlike, say, the Soviets, who weren't, you know, sort of suppressing the IAEA or international nuclear monitors necessarily to tamp down reports about radiation levels. They couldn't do that. The Chinese had a little bit more levers, but still. And then you had, I think, valiant people within China. You had the famous doctor who was trying to call out how serious this virus was, the infection rate, the what it was doing to people's respiratory systems. And then he ended up dying himself. And there was this great deal of a clampdown by the Chinese authorities. This was out of the Soviet playbook in some ways, I think, with Chernobyl, Jim. Although, as you see in the miniseries, they realized they weren't necessarily holding daily press conferences, but they were mindful of needing to take very swift action to get under control, as the Chinese eventually did as well.
Bob, I have to give you mad props here because I first learned about the virus in China from you when we were taping a podcast, I think the first week in January, and we were talking about our figures of the week, and this is what you had flagged for us. So you were on this story when it was a pre-story in many ways. It certainly wasn't being covered substantially in the mainstream media.
Oh, man.
Try to be a tripwire whenever I can.
I will say that after the miniseries aired, there was an uptick in Instagram influencers going and taking photos, breaking into the area and taking selfies in Chernobyl. So sidebar there on reactions to people learning about it, but also, you know, getting intrigued by disaster, I guess.
And we should note the original reactor still covered by a sarcophagus, still very, very dangerous.
Will be for a very, very, very long time.
Jim, how about you? What have you been watching, listening to, or what have you?
I've been listening to something, Bob, that I want to talk about, but I got to do sort of 2 points before I get there. The first is I just realized that we didn't do our standard disclaimer that in talking about books we've read, we have this rule that we don't talk about books written by people at the Council on Foreign Relations. And so I just want to say that's why we haven't talked about Richard Haass's new book, The World, A Brief Introduction, or our colleague Mira Rapp-Hooper's book, The Shields of the Republic. So I just want to put that out there before my colleagues start saying, I thought you liked my book. Why didn't you flag it for us? So that's just that I want to do that. Second thing is I really want to talk about podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts, particularly history podcasts. Again, I'm a big history buff. But before I sort of talk about the podcast that has really caught my attention right now, I want, if I can, just to put Gabrielle on the spot for a moment because she hosts a great podcast, Why It Matters. I don't know how many of our listeners have caught it yet. I hope they will. If they haven't, listened to it as soon as they finish this episode. But can I just hear a little bit from you, Gabrielle, about how you think about doing your podcast? Because you talk about doing stories. You do them so incredibly well. Just gonna tell us a little bit about that sort of art.
I think something we just always try to keep in mind is that the podcast is geared towards a general audience that isn't fully read in on international relations and foreign policy, but is interested. And I think that sort of defines me as a host as well. You know, my background is actually in arts and culture journalism. I spent years covering like the New York art scene and going to music festivals. And I think part of this is that I'm just learning along with the listener. And, you know, that's the most genuine and true feeling that I have going into it. And when we pick topics, we just sort of go from large overarching issues, like we did one on fast fashion consumption or the, you know, proliferation of space junk, to issues like, you know, Bob mentioned earlier, the Indian government's pushback on, you know, WhatsApp and tracking messages. And every time we do it, the idea is just trying to explain something that's happening abroad that can and will affect us at home, wherever home may be. And, you know, sometimes that process involves 20 pitches, you know, one of which gets through. But it's always an interesting process trying to find which stories we think will bridge the gap of maybe not following everything so closely when it comes to IR and foreign policy, but knowing that the story is out there.
My favorite cold open was for the fast fashion episode, Gabrielle, where you were in your closet rummaging through the unworn layers of clothes that you had accumulated.
Yep.
I just have to ask you one other question, Gabrielle, on this. Is there one episode in particular that you did when you were done, you said, I'm exceptionally proud of that?
We did just do an episode on human trafficking, specifically on labor trafficking. And I, you know, went into it with a little bit of hesitancy. I have to say, you know, it's, first of all, it's a hard time to release an episode that you're concerned maybe you'll make people have something else to worry about, you know, on their plate. They're balancing so much and you really want to do justice to the situation and to the story. One of the main things that we pushed was that we knew we wanted to talk to a survivor, and we pushed hard and we got this amazing woman named Susie, who was a survivor of labor trafficking. And I have to say, speaking to her is one of the most rewarding experiences I've ever had. She was so bright and happy and light at the end of the day, and to have gone through something and to still have this incredible sense of hope and wanting to help other people, it was just an incredibly rewarding experience for me. And I think it really came together for the listener.
Well, you're right. That was an exceptional podcast episode. And I want to give you two thumbs up for doing it. But I promise you, I would talk about what podcast has sort of caught my attention. I've been listening to, again, I listen to a lot of history podcasts. I've mentioned some of them in past summer specials. The one I've really been listening to recently is something done by Radiolab. It's called More Perfect, and it's four seasons of episodes telling the story of important Supreme Court cases. And it is exceptionally well done. And if I have any complaint about it, is that they're only four seasons. It ends in late December of 2018. But it is a really good introduction for people who aren't lawyers into major court cases that the Supreme Court has decided, why they matter, how they affect people in their day-to-day lives. I mean, some of them are court cases people may have learned about in history. Think, for example, Marbury versus Madison, which was decided in 1803 and set up the whole notion that the Supreme Court could decide what's constitutional and what's not. Other episodes on things like Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, where the Supreme Court decided that corporations are people for the purposes of free speech, and so had those rights. But also they have episodes on court cases you've probably never heard about that have had significant consequences. So for example, a case known as Batson versus Kentucky, which was the 1986 ruling that sought to prevent race-based jury selection that may have made things more difficult rather than improve them, or something known as Filotiga versus Peña Irala, which is a 1984 case based on a little-known, to the average person, law passed in the 18th century called the Alien Tort Statute. And it's a law that's only, I think, only one sentence long that formed the basis of much of America's human rights litigation in the 20th century and into the 21st century. And much like Why It Matters, and why I like Why It Matters, is the people who have put together More Perfect are really good at telling stories. And I mean, I was struck in terms of how they did it. They title the episode that is on Marbury versus Madison, a very dry case I can recall learning about in high school history way back in the 1970s when Jimmy Carter was president. The episode is titled Kittens Kick the Giggly Blue Robot All Summer. And I will let people listen to the episode so they can figure out why they come up with that title. But it's just a very engaging set of stories about issues of great importance that affect people in our day-to-day lives. And it doesn't require going to Harvard or Yale Law School to understand.
I love that podcast too, Jim. One of the things I like about it is, as you noted, the production values, the editing of it, also the way they bring to life the personalities of the justices who are weighing in on different issues, you know, whether it's like Thurgood Marshall. I think I got my best introduction to Thurgood Marshall, the way he worked, the way he thought through some of the episodes that involved his role. And so it's one of those podcasts that, despite the subject matter, it's one of the handful of ones where, you know, you have those so-called driveway moments where you just pull in. If I'm by myself, which is usually when I am when I'm listening to that one, I have to hear how it turns out. I can't just like abruptly stop it and pick up some other time because they just wrap you up and tie you into the subject so interestingly. And it's a civics lesson done so engagingly that I think it's a great public service.
Yeah, it is really a great public service. And you're quite right, Bob, about how they bring justices to life so that they are flesh and blood people with passions and drives and ambitions. And it's all put out there. And I mean, one of my favorites is you have John Marshall. He's one of the, perhaps the greatest Supreme Court Chief Justice. He's the one that gave us judicial review in Marbury versus Madison. Who was his second cousin? Thomas Jefferson. Who did he despise? Thomas Jefferson. Oh, by the way, Thomas Jefferson returned the favor. So you have that sort of family dynamic go going on. Or even there's another episode, which is about a case called Baker v. Carr, which is one that many people would be surprised to hear Earl Warren, another great chief justice, say was the most important decision made in his tenure. This is the man who was chief justice and gave us Brown versus the Board of Education, which I would have thought naturally was the most important decision that his court had handed down. But he focused on Baker v. Carr, and he goes through why he thought it was most important. And it's just, I think it's, again, it's a great civics lesson that doesn't feel like someone is giving you a civics lesson.
You know, you guys keep giving hat tips to why it matters, which I have not paid for, but I appreciate greatly. You know, and in the spirit of that, you've both been at this for quite a while. And I'm curious, you know, what you think about today's podcasting landscape. Did you expect it to become this huge platform that it is?
Bob, how long ago did we start doing The World Next Week?
Well, we marked 10 years last fall, Jim. It was actually a bit earlier than that. So I think we're getting close on, we're right at, I think, the 11-year mark right about now, Jim. I think it was, it was 2009. Summer was just peeking around the corner, and we sat down and started going over it. It's a good point, Gabrielle. I mean, it's a medium that in many ways is made for the United States. And it obviously the pod emerging from the iPods created by Apple, and my mother for years still called it the iPod. She would listen to my iPod every week. But I'm kind of surprised how long it took for them to really catch fire. And I think it was partly that Serial series that was created, like the true crime series, and many others, really well done, that really riveted people. But you know, you think about the amount of driving that goes on and hopefully will go on in the future, maybe to a lesser extent. You know, people now doing more walking. I'm certainly doing a lot more walking in my neighborhood or jogging or whatever. And then the many voices in the many communities in a place like the United States and our tradition of media and of sharing stories, it just seemed perfect for it. It just, I think it took something to light the fire and show maybe that there was some money behind it, was part of it, maybe. Because like when Jim and I started, it was a few big ones, as I recall, and some that were backed up by major entities like NPR. Maybe TED Talks was starting to repurpose some of theirs and a few others and spinoffs from places like the BBC. But now you have individuals who are just becoming their own entities. And, you know, I think we're better for it. It's a great new thing. The only problem is there's never enough time, and there's going to be less time because more are being created every day.
Bob's right. I saw a cartoon, I think it was in the New Yorker, which had the punchline, there are now more podcasts than there are podcast listeners as the genre has proliferated. And I say that not the competition issue, but as somebody who likes to listen to podcasts, there are just so many out there and there's so many talented people doing podcasts. And I'm a big fan of something called the History of England podcast, which began as a guy who talks about how he did it literally from his shed. And it's an absolutely wonderful experience. And he tells lots of stories and he's a very engaging personality. But I subscribe to probably 20 podcasts and I'm now having problems, I think, with my phone because I may have too many podcasts downloaded given the memory I have on my phone. But it probably has an upside, which is you mentioned, Bob, you like to listen to podcasts when you walk. I do as well. And I'm probably doing more walking, not stopping at my house, but continuing around the block for a couple of times, precisely because I want to hear how the story turns out. I think podcasts tap into that sort of basic human desire to want to hear a story.
Definitely. And it's something we can continue right now. It's one of those isolated activities that we can keep recording right now, sitting in three different places, but we can keep making a show, which I think is really lucky as well. So, I mean, those were some great recommendations. I'm curious, what about something else that you've been listening to or watching that's, you know, a little more lighthearted during this quarantine? Bob?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to come up with lighthearted at the moment. Not that I don't have my moments of lightheartedness, but I found myself drawn towards more, let's say, sober, but not necessarily totally sobering content that I would still strongly recommend. In these moments of American introspection about what's been playing out after the George Floyd killing, I was thinking about some of the things that both of you have raised in the course of this podcast, which is learning about our history, learning about how we can get better as a country in various ways. I'm thinking of two miniseries, both dating back, one of them's 30 years old, one of them's 33 years old. I'll go with the 30-year-old one first because it's chronological. And that is the epic Civil War series of Ken Burns, which I think there's now been a generation that has elapsed since it came out. It was a huge deal when it came out. It was must viewing. Teachers were lining up to make it part of lesson plans. But people were just sitting down because of fascination with the Civil War in any event, which was already there. And Ken Burns did this masterful job, which is now repeated everywhere, of taking archival information, letters, photographs, which were just just starting to come out at war, probably the first highly photographed war, and just making them come to life. And then also there was original music composed for it. There was masterful narration and a whole host of narrators that really brought it to life. And so as a way of understanding this epical moment in the country and in this wrenching moment, this moment that still has overtones, as we're talking about what the country is going through right now, the state of Virginia is trying to get a Robert E. Lee statue removed from the Capitol in Richmond and facing difficulty in doing that. Confederate flags are still an issue in the U.S. Armed Forces. The naming of bases after Confederate generals is still an issue. And so I think it's a really good place to start. It's also something I'm going to make my two daughters sit down and watch and make it interesting and engaging for them to do, not as like taking their spinach. And I would pair that with a really well done and I think a little bit forgotten miniseries called Eyes on the Prize, also created under PBS, came out in 1987. And it traces the civil rights movement from 54 into the mid-60s in the United States. Again, they were able to, in that time period, they were able to tap into sources and people who were there, who were still alive and still able to go over what was playing out in the country and really what things had not changed or what things had sort of established a debilitating status quo in the post-Civil War era in the country. And Jim mentioned the Jim Crow laws and there was segregation. So many things that needed to be repaired. And suddenly there was this movement among African-Americans, but also religious leaders, both Black and white, and other parts of society to try to bring about reforms that ended up emerging in the 1960s. Obviously, we're not there yet in terms of realizing what had been sought in those. But I think a series like Eyes on the Prize also gives you a grounding in that effort and what they were facing at that time, which was also just stunning when you look at what was happening in the country. Returning World War II vets who had to go and return to southern towns where they weren't allowed to walk on the same sidewalk as white people and things like that. At a time when we're trying to educate ourselves and everybody's trying to learn more about the country's history and how it can improve, I think these two series in the best tradition of American kind of documentary making could be a good addition to it. And by the way, Eyes on the Prize is available on YouTube for free, I was happy to see. And the Civil War series, which I still have on VHS tapes that I have kept over the years.
Bob, I have to ask, do you still have a device that will play VHS?
Jim, I have a multiplayer that allows me to play DVDs and VHS tapes. And I also have my Bluetooth player nearby. I refuse to part with my VHS tapes. Sorry.
I may have to borrow it from you because I have a whole collection of VHS tapes, but I have nothing that can play it. Now, I know Gabriel doesn't know what VHS tapes are, but I got to say, those are two terrific documentaries. And I think in some ways, you know, Ken Burns' Civil War series is like the gold standard against which every other sustained documentary, multi-episode documentary is compared to.
And if I sat down and watched these back to back, would it be like a full day of just action-packed?
I would give yourself some time, but if you did it in a condensed time, though, Gabrielle, you would be able to lecture on the issue because you would have such a grounding, and you'd be also so full of purpose and mission after seeing them. Not that you're not now, but I mean, what they convey and the just the staggering scale of sources and people that they cite are just, you know, again, it's great documentary making for issues that persist and, you know, continue to weigh on the country heavily.
I also want to say that Eyes on the Prize, I think, is really worth watching for younger people who didn't live through the civil rights movement, because it's one thing to read about it in the pages of the book about Bull Connor and the German Shepherds. It is another thing to witness it.
Yeah,
it is absolutely another thing to see what happened when the people tried to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And I think that's just, it's a rich, important part of American history. And it's worth watching as we see what's unfolding before our very eyes in these weeks.
Well, Jim, I'll turn to you now. Are you going to go in a lighthearted direction or a thoughtful direction? What do you think?
Well, I was hoping I was going to go in a lighthearted and thoughtful direction, or a thoughtfully lighthearted direction, Bob.
Okay.
I was trying to take the instructions I got from our producer and senior producer seriously. You know, as I was sort of looking around for things I was looking forward to, there are certainly a lot of things on all these streaming channels that I would love to watch, old movies that I'd like to see again because they would speak to me today and I want to, or see, you know, do I think about them differently now than I did when I saw them 10, 20, 30 years ago. There's obviously new shows that have come out that I'd like to watch that friends who have more free time than I do have watched and said, you got to see this. And of course, I want to watch The Mandalorian, which I kept reading about and people were telling me was really terrific. And it's very important to the whole Star Wars franchise. I haven't seen it yet because it's on Disney Plus and I do not have Disney Plus. However, I'm going to get Disney Plus because of something I do want to see very, very much, which is Hamilton. Not the book, I've already mentioned the book by Ron Chernow, but Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway musical, Hamilton, which is going to debut on Disney Plus.
July 3rd.
July 3rd. and I was unable to get tickets to go see the musical on Broadway. Same. I'm not sure I, even if I were offered the opportunity, I want to pay that much for the privilege of going to see it. These are not inexpensive tickets. But again, they filmed one of the shows on Broadway. It's now going to be on television again on Disney Plus starting June 3rd. And I'm looking forward to seeing it because, again, I think it tells a very important story about who we are, and the way Lin-Manuel Miranda tells the story is so genius. I mean, it's clever, it's different, it's innovative, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing it.
I was going to say, I never got to see it, but I did see In the Heights. Did you ever see In the Heights?
No, I have not seen In the Heights.
Which was really great. But yeah, oh, I'm thrilled that it's going to be something we can watch. What do you think about, you know, I mean, obviously the situation we're in right now does encourage people to have, you know, theater and dance and opera being presented in your home. But what do you think about plays that are, you know, presented through your TV screen?
Well, they're never going to be the same experience as when you are in a theater with people feeling live. That's why you like live performances, because there is something just quintessentially different about that experience. But quite honestly, right now, Broadway shut down at least into the fall, perhaps longer. Same for all sorts of touring companies and the rest. I happen to live across from the Studio Theater here in Washington, D.C. They do a lot of great plays. I like to go there, but again, they're closed and not. So it's something fundamentally different, but it's still important. I think it is still terrific entertainment, and it's an opportunity to sort of see what the artist has created, what message they're trying to communicate. And again, you know, part of the experience about witnessing, whether it's a movie or a play, a musical, a music concert, is the context in which you're witnessing it. And I think it'll be very interesting to see Hamilton at this particular time. I suspect, again, I haven't seen the musical, but I suspect that there are elements in that musical that resonate with what's happening on the streets here in Washington, in D.C., and in cities and towns around America in that show. So,
no, it was one of those obvious strikes of genius. I think Lin-Manuel Miranda has multiple genius arrows in his quiver, but this one obviously just hit home. And then the way he composed the various songwriting approaches he took to telling the country story through Hamilton's story was just amazing. I actually heard it for the first time, heard anything about it from a podcast. It was an NPR offshoot podcast that had gotten a hold of a couple of samples of music. And I thought right away, oh man, this sounds just great. And they had one of the NPR's, I think, hip hop music critics on with them who had just come from seeing it. He saw an early version of it. He said he was prepared to be disappointed, not like it. And he said he just was mesmerized. And, you know, it's great. And it's I think it speaks to how effective it is because of its transgenerational appeal. Like my kids who are 11 and 13, my older daughter knows the words to like half the songs already from hearing it, you know, downloading some of them on iTunes, kids in her sort of drama groups and things knowing it already. We were actually set to go and see it at the Kennedy Center, the traveling version of it. And like everything else, the Kennedy Center had to shut down and postpone it, hopefully to come back at a later time. So I think we're going to go the Disney Plus route too, Jim.
Well, Gabrielle, now that I've confessed that I'm not hip, that I was not at the debut of Hamilton on Broadway, can you share with us sort of what you're looking forward to seeing?
Yeah. You know, just quickly podcast-wise, some things that I absolutely love and are a great departure. You know, if you just want some really great light distractions, just Reply All, which is, you know, hosted by PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman. And they analyze just different stories related to technology and the internet. They break down popular tweets. The Dream Season 1, which analyzes MLMs, multi-level marketing. It is an incredible dive into a business that a lot of us are completely unfamiliar with. And for something more health-focused, America Dissected by Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. He analyzes different issues through a healthcare lens. Obviously, right now, it's really switched over to the current pandemic. But before then, you know, he did some deep dives into the anti-vax movement, just a bunch of different topics that it's really great to have that angle on it. But the series I wanted to talk about is actually High Fidelity on Hulu. So for me, it's sort of the remake I never thought I wanted or needed. You know, when the quarantine started in March, quarantine for us, working from home, it was a struggle. And I had a hard time adapting to this, you know, new isolated world. And I was just on the hunt to take my mind off of things. And people recommended it. And I kind of put it off for a while. But I think it's just delightful. It's a Hulu series remake of the 2000 film starring John Cusack, based on the book by Nick Hornby. And Zoe Kravitz is in the role of Rob, which was originally played by John Cusack in the movie. For those who haven't seen or read it, Rob owns a record store, and the movie and the series basically follow as this character goes down this list of their top five breakups and reconnects with the people they dated to sort of see what went wrong. And the series is set up very similarly, but I find that it does this amazing job of reinventing the friendships and the relationships that Rob has in this modern way that's super relatable. And when it was done, I went back and I watched the movie, and I remember liking the movie, but I truly just don't understand how I thought it was charming, because, you know, John Cusack's version of Rob is very much an irredeemable character. And it was interesting to me too that it didn't translate to today, at least for me, but the way that they did the series absolutely did. And an added layer to it is just that in quarantine, I find myself missing my city. And the movie takes place in Chicago, but the series takes place in New York. And it's filmed all around the neighborhoods that I call home: Crown Heights, Williamsburg, Bed-Stuy. And watching it during quarantine was almost like this, you know, this dose of home that I wasn't able to, you know, take advantage of. It was the record stores and the restaurants and the bars and just this free and easy attitude that you sort of took for granted. And I just thought it was a perfect departure from, you know, whatever anxieties we're feeling at the moment. And I just really think it's an excellent series.
Is it introducing new music? You know, I think one of the things that's memorable about the movie also is Jack Black, which I think was his first big role, just kind of being this insufferable, you know, snob about music.
Yeah, so it does bring back some of the music, which is great because the music in the film is wonderful, but it does introduce a bunch of new music, which is wonderful. It does actually, both the movie and the series end on the same Stevie Wonder song, which is, you know, fabulous, but the music is absolutely a shining point of both, and the series really ups it a notch.
So I want to ask you, Gabrielle, just to go off topic here, you are a culture and art journalist. So as you look out at this particular moment in American history, what do you think the big story is to be written about American culture?
I think there are many. I think there's something to be said about music and art has and always will play an incredible role in these times. I know, Jim, you even wrote a piece that gets a lot of traffic about protest songs. You know, you can't separate these two. And I've even noticed at the protests I'm going to, people are singing, people are playing music. You know, people are posting pieces of art they're making at home. Like you said, theater has moved online. I think one of the big pieces to take away from this is that just because you can't see it in person, just because you can't dance next to someone, just because you can't see it in a museum, doesn't mean that art isn't playing this tremendous role in everything that we're going through right now. And I think we're going to see some amazing stuff come out of this, and I'm looking forward to it.
One thing I will say is I hope there is some documentary filmmaker out there who has gone down to the White House in recent days and filmed the posters that have been affixed to the fence that's been put up around the White House. Now, the fence is supposed to come down actually as we're taping this show, but it is to me remarkable. It is moving. It is, in some sense, the embodiment of the people expressing their wishes, their fears, and concerns. And when I think about art, I know we talk about art as something that's in a museum somewhere. And to me, as I was walking down, I guess it's I Street, where the fence is, to me, this was art. This was sort of we the people speaking and expressing their views, making their demands on government to address the challenges that they face. And I think that this is a pivotal moment in American history. And again, I hope something good comes of it, that we go a little bit further along the arc of the more perfect union.
Jim, well put. As someone who's usually works close by the White House, seeing that the fences go up was a bit of an affront, to say the least. But seeing the transformation of those fences and then hearing Bill Withers' Lean on Me echo around, it does speak to the spirit of the country. Not to get too maudlin, but I do think it does speak to the better natures of people and maybe better times ahead.
And with that, we're going to wrap up our summer entertainment special episode. I want to let everybody know that I'm going to post on my blog, The Water's Edge, at cfr.org, a list of all of the books, movies, documentaries, podcasts, and musicals that we have mentioned on today's show. And I want to say to all of our regular listeners, we hope you've enjoyed this special episode. And I hope that you'll tune in 2 weeks for our regular look at the world next week. And I just want to say, Gabrielle, thank you very much for stopping by. Why It Matters is a terrific podcast. Good luck with the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tweet us your favorite international relations reads and foreign film recommendations, and also your favorite podcasts at CFR_org using the hashtag TWNW. Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlett. Special thanks to Dr. Anna Greitzer for her assistance. Zoe Collis also served as our recording engineer this week. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying keep safe and have a great summer.